So I think that is a lesson that policymakers should be thinking about. If I devise these very simple programs that look more and more like UBI type programs, keep the criteria pretty simple, then the state can do a lot of the work of managing the burden.
Well, welcome back to the Public Money Pod, a production of the Center for Municipal Finance at the University of Chicago's Harris School of Public Policy. And we are, of course, proudly sponsored by Odyssey Advisors, the Government Finance Officers Association, MuniPro, and Build America Mutual. I'm Justin Marlowe, and I'm joined, as always, by my intrepid co-host, purveyor of long story short, Marylander, Californian, baseball mom on the way, I would think, with the springtime, Liz Farmer. Liz, welcome back.
Thanks, Justin. You know, last week I mentioned about how we were having our fake spring. Well, and second winter was coming. Well, it's here. It is cold. The wind is howling. I mean, it sounds like a Halloween movie outside. but I think this is the last blast, hopefully, before real spring comes. But I'm sort of, you know, wish I had knocked on wood or something like that.
Yeah, the minute you say it is the minute it comes roaring back, for sure.
Yep.
Yeah, and same here. In fact, I was just talking to someone this morning who's a transplant from New York, and she was asking about, well, when should I officially hang my winter coat up in the closet? And I said, probably about June 1st or thereabouts. you never really know right up to that point.
That's lovely.
So we're really fortunate today to have Professor Don Moynihan from the McCourt School of Public Policy at Georgetown University joining us on the pod. He's an eminent scholar and somebody who a lot of us have been reading and following and have a lot of respect for a long time now. And the topic is what he likes to call administrative burden, which is a way of thinking about all the various costs that people encounter when they interact with government services at federal, state, local, all levels, really. Very important topic, and one that is, I guess you could say, both tangential but also really central to the way we think about public money. Obviously, when we start talking about people interacting with state Medicaid programs, state unemployment insurance programs, local support for affordable housing, all these really large-scale social programs, particularly social safety net programs that are offered by states and localities. The dollars add up very quickly. These are some of the most expensive things that state and local government does. And the question of how people access those services or don't access those services, or if they access them in the most efficient way, become very important big-dollar items in state and local budgets. And so it's a great topic and a great opportunity for us to learn a lot about what his work tells us about where and when and how administrative burden happens and what's being done to try to alleviate it and what the implications of that might be for how we think about public money. You know, Liz, this is certainly not a new topic, administrative burden, red tape, everything that's in that kind of family, something that we've talked a lot about over the years. And certainly every reporter, everybody who, all the good government groups who follow government love to point out stories about when real hassle and administrative burden, red tape, gets the best of people in some cases. So this is a time-honored tradition. And of course, a lot of the argument on behalf of red tape and administrative burden is that you need to have accountability. You want to make sure that the people who are eligible to receive these benefits are receiving them and not people who are not eligible for these benefits. And we want to know where the public money goes. We want to have some visibility into what kind of impact it had. And so you need to have some accountability. The question is, how do you strike that balance between having just enough and not too much? At the same time, the pandemic was a really interesting moment to study these things because so much of the regular rules about who gets programs, how you apply, who's eligible, were either suspended or in some cases thrown out the window altogether during the pandemic. And so there's been this surge of interest in these topics because we've had a chance to study them and how they've worked in very different ways. You have done some of that work on your own when you think about the administrative burden in the both pre and post pandemic world. What comes to mind for you?
Yeah, so much. And the pandemic really was this window into a what-if scenario in terms of public benefits and even federal grant dollars. And that's something that I really kind of got into with the American Rescue Plan funding and the state and local fiscal recovery fund money that went directly to all units of local government, and you know, right down to a town, you know, with fewer than 500 people in it, could get direct money from the federal government. Not only was something like that unprecedented, it was very, very new for governments to get federal dollars. And so there was a lot of concern about how are small governments who are not used to all of the rigmarole that comes along with getting a grant and reporting it back on how it was spent, how are they going to handle that? And what was interesting to me is just like we saw with the money that went directly to families and to people who are unemployed, with local governments, in particular those smaller ones, the rules for the American Rescue for that state and local fiscal recovery fund money, well, they did keep getting adjusted. The intention behind a lot of the rules geared towards smaller cities and towns was to reduce that administrative burden, to make it easier for them to accept money, to spend it how they needed to spend it, and then report back in a way that was as easy as possible. Now, the experience of actually doing that, I'm sure varies depending on, you know, from town to town, but the iterations that I saw of those rules that came out, each step to me as far as that administrative burden goes, seemed to be in continuing in that direction of trying to at least make it easier. And of course, there's, as you mentioned, concerns. The reason that some of these things are in place is because we don't want people to misspend the money, and we do need to keep track. And there's a lot of importance placed on, well, did the money that we spend, did it work? And all of that's important. But I think the pandemic showed us that those things can still happen while also just getting the money out the door. And it was an emergency situation. However, I do think that there are a lot of lessons that have kind of sunk in for people about that whole process.
Well, we are pleased to welcome to the Public Money Pod Professor Don Moynihan from the McCourt School of Public Policy at Georgetown University. Renowned scholar, real pleased to have him. Welcome, Don. Thanks for taking the time.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Don, welcome. You've done so much writing and research on the barriers between the people who need government benefits and the actual process it takes to get access to those benefits, otherwise known as maybe administrative burden, or some people call it red tape, but I think there's a difference between the two, and you've talked about this. What can you tell us what the difference is between administrative burden and the red tape that people like to complain about?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of different ways of distinguishing between the two. And one is, from purely an academic perspective, there is a literature that defines itself as red tape. And it mostly centers on public administration experiences, often focuses on bureaucratic experiences of frictions. So how difficult it is to hire someone or to purchase a piece of equipment if you are a public employee has historically given less attention to the public's experience of frictions, and also tends to focus on rules or processes, whereas the administrative burden work tends to focus or is sort of centered on people's experiences rather than rules. Now, the two are connected in practice. So the administrative burden work, I think, is related to the literature on red tape, draws insights from it, but I think is more focused on the public, is more focused on experiences, and is a little bit more attentive to the variation in types of experiences. So one big distinction in the administrative burden, the framework that I and Pamela Hurd and others have worked on, is trying to think about what are the types of costs that people encounter. So rather than just defining it as red tape, which, you know, everyone has this intuitive idea that there's some sort of annoying hassle as paperwork or you spend time waiting in line, to try and be more specific about those experiences. And so we basically say most frictions in your interactions with government services can be broken down into one of three costs. The first is learning costs. So figuring out about public sector programs or services, whether you're eligible, what you have to do, what information you might have to pull together. This is not information that we're born with, so it takes some time and effort for us to accumulate it. The second type of cost is compliance costs, and this is more like the classic understanding of red tape, which is that you have to fill out forms, you have to fill out paperwork, you may have to pull together documentation, you might spend some time waiting for services, sometimes perhaps you have to pay a fee, or you have to travel long distances. And we think about that bucket as compliance costs. And then the third category are psychological costs. So people's emotional responses to their interactions with state services. And this can vary from frustration, you know, when you've waited a long time at an office, to maybe a sense of stress if you're worried about getting some sort of benefit that might make the difference between whether your family is going to be hungry or not at the end of the month. Or in some cases, it could be fear if it's in the context of a coercive citizen-state interaction where you're interacting with the police or immigration services. And we think of that final category in particular, the psychological experiences of the state, is not one that we've really spent a ton of time thinking about in much of our social science study of citizen-state interaction, certainly from the public administration or public policy perspective that I'm familiar with. And so I think that's one of the bigger contributions, is to try and think of that as related to these other types of costs that people experience.
Thinking about all those costs, on this being the Public Money Pod, of course, we naturally start to think in terms of financial costs. Are, in your work or any other work that you're aware of, has anyone tried to tally up the financial costs to the extent that you can think of those three buckets of costs in financial terms?
Yeah, so I think very crudely, yes, but precisely, no. And so just to back that answer out a little bit, There is this piece of legislation called the Paperwork Reduction Act that some folks listening might be familiar with, where if you've ever filled out a federal form, somewhere in the form it will tell you this should take you about 15 minutes or 30 minutes or, you know, an hour to complete that form. And that's required by law for federal forms. They come up with those estimates in the federal government, then they can calculate how many people have completed those forms in a given year, and then they can estimate from that. The federal government generated something like 10 million or 10, I think 10 billion hours was the last figure I saw, worth of people's time completing those forms in a given year. How accurate those estimates are, I don't know. I think they're probably an underestimate. The estimates reflect how much time OMB assumes it takes you to complete a form, so the compliance cost, but not necessarily how much time it takes you to pull together the documentation that the form might require. But like, let's just take that $10 billion number, which I think comes from about 2015. Cass Sunstein, who's also written a lot about this topic using the term sludge, just did a back of the envelope calculation and said, well, if you value people's time at $10 an hour or $20 an hour or $30 an hour, you can easily calculate what is the cost of that time tax. And so if you look at the BLS estimates of, you know, what is the average hourly wage, and we're taking up 10 billion hours, if the average hourly wage is something like $30, then that's, you know, $300 billion worth of people's time. And again, probably an underestimate, but that's also larger than the budget of many federal agencies in a given year. And so if you think about that as a time tax, that's a pretty large tax that goes unrecognized. And Annie Lowry, the writer from The Atlantic, has used this term, the time tax, in a way that I think makes it a little bit easier for people to see that time, to recognize that it is something that they are being compelled to give up and that it has value. Now, like I said, I think those are underestimates of people's times. They don't account for learning costs. They don't account for psychological costs. But even if you just take those back of the envelope calculations, it's a pretty large amount of time that people spend on this topic.
How are these costs distributed? And I guess by that, I mean, do some people tend to deal with this more often, and perhaps they can't afford to, or they can't afford to? I mean, who here is really being affected by this?
That's a great question. So I think one way to think about this is who tends to be clients for the most burdensome programs. And the most burdensome programs are probably going to be programs that have a lot of eligibility criteria or demand a lot of paperwork in order to satisfy bureaucratic requirements. So by and large, those types of programs are going to be means-tested anti-poverty programs. where there is, you know, a fair degree of paperwork, and you have to renew every 6 months or every year your status. You have to document things like whether you're working or not on a regular basis. So if you have lower income and you are dependent upon means-tested programs with a lot of requirements, then you probably have a lot more administrative burden in your life. If you are better off, and let's say you have a steady job and you're in a happy situation that your employer offers you health care, you're still going to have to deal with a lot of the hassles of the healthcare system in general, but just getting and maintaining that health insurance is going to be a less burdensome process, right? You sign up once, and then if you do nothing, they just keep rolling you over in your old plan from 1 year to the next. Now, both those programs, like your private health insurer provided programs and public programs like Medicare or Medicaid, these are all publicly subsidized health programs. But one of them has much fewer burdens than the others. In order to maintain access to health insurance, you're just spending a lot less time with processes in a private employer situation than you would be if you were trying to apply for Medicaid or Medicare. So I think it's a nice illustration of how, in many cases, we've built supports for lots of different types of members of the public to access things that they value, but we've made it harder for some groups versus others in order to access those services. So I think that's sort of part one of the answer to your question. The second part is when you look within these groups and say, imagine this population of lower income people who are dependent on Medicaid or SNAP. Within that group, who is going to struggle more to access services? And I think we have increasing evidence that the distribution of benefits and the distribution of burdens is not going to fall evenly within that population. And this is really an interesting empirical question, partly because there's this older model within economics, the sort of ordeal mechanism model, which starts with the assumption that a good way of targeting public resources is to start by saying, if you add in a certain amount of friction, only the people who really need it, really need the service, are going to be the ones who will deal with the hassles. Like if you make the lines a bit longer, the people who don't really need that service will just say it's not worth it for me, and those will tend to be higher income people who could, you know, subsidize their own healthcare or whatever service we're talking about, and the truly needy will be the ones who will spend hours in line for those services. And that's a rational neoclassical model of how we might think about people deal with burdens. But I think there are some problems with that model. One is that it doesn't really account for human capacities and variations in human capital. So if I have, let's say, poor health and I am unable to wait in line for hours, then I may not get that service, even if I need it because I have poor health, right? So there's sort of a catch-22 aspect to it. Or if I'm experiencing scarcity because I have no one to cover childcare at home, or I have a young kid with me who is sick or yelling, I'm not going to wait that line for hours and hours. And so I may exit. Or if I have lower education, I may struggle more with the compliance costs of reading the documents or pulling together documents that demonstrate my eligibility. And we have some evidence for all of those factors, as well as mental health. If you have sort of mental health issues such as ADD, you're less likely to have the executive function that allows you to deal with slow, onerous processes where you have to persevere through them. And so I think what that tells you then is within broad low-income populations, you might have variation in the people who are willing to persevere with these sort of hassles. And contrary to an ordeals model, the people who might need the services more might be the ones who are less willing to deal with the hassles. There's a nice paper a couple of years ago by Deshpande and Lee that looked at the closure of Social Security field offices. I may have been in Chicago. As sort of a natural experiment to look at what happens when frictions rise. So there's fewer Social Security field offices, people who are trying to get disability benefits through Social Security then have to travel further or spend more time dealing with the hassles. And what they found was that people who tended to be less likely to win in that scenario of higher frictions are people who had lower education and moderately more severe disabilities. So it wasn't the people that needed the support less, it was the people who could deal with the hassles and the additional travel and the additional time less.
Getting into the government side of it just a little bit more, are there scenarios where you can reduce that burden on both the user and the administrator on the other end?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think it gets at a not irrational concern on the part of government, which is that if we make it really easy for people to deal with us, then it's going to generate such a flow of demand that we're going to be overwhelmed. Like, I can think about scenarios where that is the case. So, for example, Stephanie Moulton has done research on mortgage debt relief services, where I think the Ohio state government did work to make it easier to access those services. And then there was this big demand, and the government didn't have the capacity to manage that demand. So I think you have to think about what are the potential trade-offs here. There are scenarios where you might think about a zero-sum game in the distribution of burden, where if I, the bureaucrat, take more burdens off the shoulders of the public, then I have to shoulder it instead. Right, so that is one scenario. There are also scenarios where policymakers might make changes that impose more burdens on both the bureaucrats and members of the public. So if you add, let's say, work reporting requirements to Medicaid, as some states are considering, that's going to make it more complicated both for citizens and the bureaucrats who now have to process this additional paperwork. And then I think there are scenarios where you can find win-wins, where if you do a couple of things, one is to simplify criteria so that you're asking less of the public to understand, but also less of administrative actors to process that information, then that becomes a win-win. Or if you, and these are not necessarily unrelated, if you can design an administrative system where the data and technology matches the eligibility criteria, then you can automate a lot of work. And so going back to the example I used earlier and looking at the ex parte or automatic Medicaid renewals in Minnesota, part of what Code for America did was to make it easier for caseworkers to access relevant data, but also to figure out how to do this in a way that was efficient for them so that they ended up spending less time per case than they would have done if they had gotten all the documentation back from an individual client, right? So that is an example of a win-win where they're not chasing down clients, say you're missing documentation, and that saves them some time. Similarly, the example I gave of interview requirements, if you tell people you have an assigned interview time and then 50% of the people don't turn up for their assigned interview slots, what that means is you have a lot of wasted administrative time. So switching to a situation where people just sort of call and queue, if they don't end up going to their original scheduled interview time, probably means you're going to lose less administrative time where administrators just have these empty slots that people don't turn up for. So I think that's another potential example of a win-win.
I think during the pandemic, that was certainly was something that a lot of people were concerned about in terms of just getting money out the door to the people who needed it. And so we saw a lot of kind of temporary lowering the walls of that administrative burden just to getting out the cash. And then later on, we've seen some universal basic income pilots, I think, based on that same notion that when you give people, you lower those burdens, people will do what they need to do with the money without that hassle. What's your, I guess, assessment of experiments and pilot programs like that, or just what happened in the pandemic with getting money out the door?
Yeah, that could be a whole other podcast because the pandemic period was like a series of really big policy experiments where all of a sudden the government was willing to throw a lot of money at policy problems in a way it normally is not, and also to relax some of the criteria that generate burdens in a way that normally they are not. And I think we should be able to look back at that and draw some lessons about how we want to design the state moving forward. And I think there are some positive lessons. So I'll take a couple. One is looking at the public health emergency. So this is there's a legal definition for what this means and how it affected Medicaid. But basically, it meant that states could not kick people off Medicaid during the period of the pandemic. And they couldn't add new and more onerous administrative procedures if they wanted to retain federal funding that was added during the pandemic. And so basically, for a while, the U.S. went from a system where you had to renew your status on a regular basis, probably every year, to one where if you did nothing, you continued to receive benefits. We switched the default. And what that meant was that a lot more people got healthcare coverage. Simply not requiring people to re-enroll every year had this huge effect in terms of increasing access to healthcare. And a paper by Laura Daig and a co-author tried to estimate the size of these effects. And they were really very large. Right? They were, in the same time period, there was more of an expansion of the insured population because of not kicking people off healthcare than there was during the same period after the introduction of the Affordable Care Act, which I find pretty remarkable. Like, we think about the Affordable Care Act, this was the biggest health policy event in decades, and it had less of an impact on coverage than simply not kicking people off every year or not forcing them to go through renewal procedures. So I think that is one, I think, lesson about the impact of forcing people to go through renewal procedures each year. Another positive lesson is looking at the child tax credit during the pandemic. So we saw an expansion of the child tax credit. It had a really large effect on reducing child poverty. There are a couple of reasons for that. One is that the benefit became more generous. The other is that it reached people it doesn't normally reach, which is to say people who had very low earnings. And normally the CTC requires that you have enough earnings so that the tax credit is offset. So it's non-refundable. And here you went to a situation where you could have income of zero and you would still get a check. And so it reached a whole other population that it normally didn't, people with very, very low income. Part of what I think was really effective about the outreach of the IRS during this time period is that when they could identify if people were eligible for the child tax credit, they just gave them the money, right? So they used administrative data and they used the very simple eligibility criteria, what your income was, how many kids do you have? And then they just gave people money. And we also saw this with the supplemental checks that went out to people during the pandemic. If you design a program where you keep it very simple, okay, we're going to give people money if their income is below a certain level and dependent on the number of dependents they have, those are like really simple criteria. And you have administrative data that tells you who is eligible for criteria, then you can automatically enroll most of the eligible population. So I think that is a lesson that policymakers should be thinking about. If I devise these very simple programs that look more and more like UBI type programs, keep the criteria pretty simple, then the state can do a lot of the work of managing the burdens. You don't have to ask people to fill out a ton of forms. There are some exceptions to this, and maybe we'll talk a little bit more about that. But by and large, I think that is a good lesson for policymakers to think about. A bad lesson from the pandemic is I'm thinking about rental assistance. So this was another thing where we're going to give money so you get to stay in your home that you're renting, right? And part of the problem with that new program is that, one, it was new, so it was unfamiliar. And number two, it required the coordination of multiple actors, not just the renter, but also the landlord. And so as soon as you start adding these other actors into the process, you make the program much more complicated because sometimes landlords don't have an incentive to participate or engage in the process, and many didn't. And so it became, I think, not a very successful program. Partly because of the newness, but also because you had multiple actors, one of whom who could basically put a veto point in place that limited the success of the programs. I think another lesson for policymakers during the pandemic is that if you have effective programs in place, it's better to expand those, even if they don't directly target the population that you care about, rather than to design these new, very niche programs that target a really specific population. So expanding SNAP, which we do, you know, it's cyclically that occurs during, you know, downturns, but also you can just make it more generous in really bad times, I think is a really good way of reaching populations, because you already have a machinery for getting the money to those people. And that's probably, you know, because it's a population that's lower income, that's probably going to reach whatever population that, that you were hoping to reach beforehand in terms of vulnerable groups.
I know that in some of your other work, you've gone in and actually studied deliberate attempts to try to reduce administrative burden, certainly outside the context of the pandemic, but in some other settings as well. When the federal government, state governments, local governments go in and deliberately try to get rid of some of this friction, what seems to work, what hasn't seemed to work?
Yeah, so I think there's a menu or a toolbox of options that we could talk about here. So one is you nudge people. So you give people information and you tell them if they're eligible for something. So let's say that's the first option. The second option is that you help people. So you give them access to someone who can walk them through an administrative process. And we do that in certain areas like having navigators for the healthcare system. The third option is you redesign the administrative process to make that simpler. And then the fourth option is, you know, sort of the most effective and most powerful option is that you shift burdens away from individuals and onto the state by automating processes so that people simply don't have to apply for something if they're eligible for it. What I'd say is we have, you know, some evidence for the success of all of those options, but the scale of the effects tends to be much greater if you go towards the last option, the automatic enrollment option. So we have been, and when I say we here, I'm thinking about the Better Government Lab at the McCord School at Georgetown University, have been working with some state governments and with Code for America, which is a civic tech nonprofit that works with state governments to try and make their safety net more accessible, looking for ways to do that. And so one project we worked on in the state of Minnesota tried to combine a number of these benefits or a number of these approaches where we simplified the application process for Medicaid renewal and then automated it so that caseworkers, if they had access to data, could see if someone was eligible and then they could simply approve them for renewal. And this was within the aged blind and disabled population. And by some estimates, there's a couple of hundred thousand people who simply no longer had to go through the process each year. And a good portion of them received services or at least did not lose services that they otherwise would have lost. But that is the ideal. If you can build a data system that empowers caseworkers or the state government to verify that you're eligible, and then automate renewal processes, that just simply does away with a lot of the administrative burdens. In the absence of that, you can do smaller things. And I think the nudge approach, the sort of informational messages, is the most appealing one because it tends to be low cost. And we have had some success with that. For example, we're working on a project now in Colorado where just telling people with reminders that they have to complete an interview to finish their SNAP application, and then also giving them information if they can't make the assigned interview time, how they can reschedule that, has these effects where it increases take up between 6 to 7% of that population, right? I think the hardest challenge for me is thinking about how to get governments interested in changing internal administrative processes. Unlike a nudge where you're just sort of outreaching to the public, you're sending them a text, you're telling government employees you need to rethink how you're doing things. And it's very hard to do that as an outside researcher. And it's also hard for government to do that because I think government doesn't have the internal incentives to reorganize and innovate on a regular basis. I've been learning a lot about human-centered design and the way in which that can be used. and the building of customer experience teams within government agencies. And so I, you know, if I was president for a day, I would be encouraging Congress to invest in that type of government capacity, because that's the type of investment that should pay off in people's experiences in government. Just having specialists who look really, really closely at administrative processes, do a bunch of A-B testing to try and figure out what works and what improves people's experiences, giving them that job of just being obsessed with customer experience. And some people hate using the term customer, but if you want to call them clients or citizens, that's fine too. I think that's important because currently no one really has that job. And instead, bureaucrats, through no fault of their own, are incentivized to design systems from a bureaucratic perspective rather than through a citizen perspective.
Well, thanks so much, Professor Don Moynihan from the McCord School of Public Policy at Georgetown University. Great conversation about administrative burden, what it means for government at large and public money in particular. Really thank you for taking the time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks again to Don Moynihan. That was such a wide-ranging conversation and full of lots of goodies that we could expand on for hours on end. And so I think our listeners will get a lot of takeaways from that, a lot of food for thought. The rip from the headlines I pulled this week is from Maine, and it was originally published by the Maine Monitor, another nonprofit and nonpartisan news organization. I'm sensing a theme here, and this is unintended, but I'll just leave that there. So this story is titled "All." It's about school lunches, and it says all Maine students can now get free lunches, no application needed. And here's what that means for poverty data. The story is written by Isha Pendekar of the Maine Monitor. And it's about how Maine was one of the first states to pass legislation providing free lunches to all students after pandemic era funding expired. It's now been adopted in seven other states. Others are being considered, are considering it around, others across the country are considering it. And again, a great example of reducing those burdens and just making something easier to access. However, the poverty data aspect of it, it says, the story says that now that parents don't have to fill out those applications to get access to free meals, the districts have lost an important source of data on low-income households, and which has traditionally been information that's been used for funding. And so the information usually has traditionally been used to allocate funding to districts and schools and identify whether students or teachers are eligible for certain grants or waivers. And so today the state is still reimbursing districts for each meal they provide, but the question is how much the state is getting from the federal government. And so their Maine is trying to figure this out. This is important data that school districts need to know. And the state needs to know. And so they're doing a bunch of outreach. Don mentioned that level too, in terms of reducing the burden. It quotes someone from an organization called Full Plates, Full Potential, which advocates for child nutrition. And it's the executive director of the organization. He says, we've worked really hard to lead outreach campaigns to get people to fill out the application. But it's one more hoop that you're asking people in poverty to jump through. And that to me right there says it. I mean, that's the whole reason that they made school lunches available to everybody, is so that people wouldn't have to jump through that particular hoop. But now how else do you get the data? So this year, the Maine Department of Education stopped using free and reduced meal data to allocate Title I funding to low-income districts. For anyone who doesn't remember, Title I funding is federal money that's meant to supplement state and local education budgets with the goal of helping low-income students who've consistently been shown to have worse educational outcomes than their wealthier peers, which is why they've directed more money to those schools. And it also, the story also adds that more than half of Maine's districts have adopted school nutrition programs that don't rely on these forms. And one more thing, it says, despite the administrative challenges and questions about funding, experts and school officials say the move to universal free lunch has been an unequivocally positive development for students. And that's a direct quote from the story as well. It goes on to give some other examples about things different schools are trying and what data has they have been able to uncover. But to me, this is just a great example of the kind of stuff that Don was talking about. But it also, to me, is an example of data, how much all this stuff is tied together. And so when you change one thing, ultimately, you know, it affects how you keep track of other things. And it's practically the definition of an unintended consequence. And so as we, work through things like that, I think this is just a heads up for other places as to, things that also might need to be rethought. Justin, what were some of the things that you got out of reading this story?
Yeah, great illustration, as you said, of a lot of the kinds of things that Don talked about, and both, like I said, the intended, the unintended, and all the other consequences that follow from this. I've said this a couple different times in response to some rip from the headlines, and I think it bears repeating here. Again, quoting our shared good friend and mentor, Mark Funkhauser, who always likes to say that from the standpoint of citizens, it's all the government, right? There's not a lot of distinction between state, local, schools, hospitals. It's all the government. And it's easy to kind of dismiss that as a simplistic view of things. And yet you hear a story like this, where naturally people would then ask, well, those data probably do exist someplace. If it's not within the school district, it might be within state government, it might be in local government, it might be. So why is it that we can't just have data that everyone is able to use and mm-hmm. and efficiently bring to bear on some of these questions about eligibility and where and when to spend money? And I think those are all fair questions. Again, the accountability concerns are always there, and data privacy, which we've talked about many times on this podcast, becomes a very big issue. But that seems in some sense a more solvable problem than the problem of asking people, as Don had said, right? There's often this zero-sum game between putting the burden of compliance on people or putting the burden of compliance on people inside of state government, and who has the more capacity and more ability and more resources to deal with that problem internally. And you could argue that it really is something that we ought to step up and do as state government. I was reminded too, as throughout this entire conversation, but especially as you were mentioning this ripper in the headlines, the Government Finance Officers Association, of course, the big professional association in state and local government finance, went through a revamp of its code of ethics roughly 7-8 years ago now, I want to say. And they took their code of ethics from being a kind of standard checklist of do's and don'ts, especially related to things like conflict of interest and a lot of those classic sort of ethics questions that come up around professional codes of ethics. And there's still some of that in the code of ethics, but they really reconfigured their entire code of ethics around this question of what does it mean for state and local government finance to work well? What are the indicators of a state and local finance function that's doing its job effectively? And maybe surprisingly, there was less emphasis than you might have expected on things like using money efficiently, or maintaining adequate reserves and so forth, and a lot of emphasis on questions of trust, right? A lot of emphasis on how people interact with their local government finance personnel. And I think that gets at the bigger sort of theory of change around why do we do what we do? If people have more positive interactions, if people believe that government is there in their best interest, as Don said, if there's a belief that the state is there to help rather than to treat you as guilty until proven innocent, then that can have all kinds of positive spillover benefits that we may have not even been thinking about. And this is a really good example of that. Like, can we improve those processes? If it's just about data, are there ways to make sure that those data are made available through other channels? And if they can be, then that's an investment worth making and one that's going to have all kinds of positive impacts down the road. So really, these are at the core public money questions, to the extent that we think that the management of public money is about building trust and having people have positive interactions with state and local government. I think this story and our entire conversation today really illustrates some places where we can get better and hopefully have some real benefits as a result. Thanks again to our Season 2 sponsors, Build America Mutual, MuniPro, Odyssey Advisors, and the Government Finance Officers Association. The Public Money Pod is a production of the Center for Municipal Finance at the University of Chicago's Harris School of Public Policy, where we are proudly produced by Hannah Burnick. You can learn more about the center and its work at munifinance.uchicago.edu. That's munifinance.uchicago.edu. You can learn more about Liz Farmer's work at her Substack, Long Story Short. That's Long Story Short. Thanks again for listening. We'll catch you next time on the Public Money Pod.